Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. This episode is brought to you by One Cause, creator of powerful peer-to-peer and online fundraising solutions, helping over 6,000 nonprofits make giving more social, mobile, and fun. Reinvent your supporter experience to drive deeper engagement, inspire giving, and motivate fundraising in a virtual world. To learn more about One Cause, visit them at www.onecause.com. Podcast listeners, I am delighted that we are wrapping up this series. We have been partnering with AFP Toronto for the last several weeks, and we've had a number of conversations. We've got the international group gathered today. They're going to have a conversation about what COVID-19 means for them, how it has affected their fundraising practices, how they're maintaining community, and so forth. Chrislyn, I think you're going to lead the conversation. So would you mind just introducing yourself and then help everybody else introduce themselves as well?
Yes, thank you, Jason. Welcome to our speakers today and our listeners out there. My name is Chrislyn Pays. I'm the manager of philanthropy at Amnesty International, based here in Toronto. We're an international movement of donors and activists that are working towards a human rights world in which everyone enjoys human rights. I am part of the Major Gifts team and also oversee the mid-level work with our donors. And I'm joined today by fellow colleagues here who are also working in international causes. And the title of our episode today, more or less, is Global Giving in the Pandemic. So I'd like to, at this point, turn it over to each of them to introduce themselves, their organization, and their role. So over to you, Linton, first to introduce yourself.
Thanks, Chrislyn. So it's Linton Carter here. I am Chief Development Officer at UNICEF Canada. I've been with UNICEF for 3.5 years now. It's my first time in the international development space, but I'm very passionate about helping vulnerable children and youth, and that's what UNICEF does. We are the world's largest humanitarian agency for children, save more children's lives than any other agency in the world. And so I've spent my career helping children's charities, mainly for children's charities in Canada. But as I said, this is my first time in the international space. So thank you for having me on the podcast.
Wonderful. Thank you, Linton. And we'll go over to Gail next.
Thank you. So Gail Black from CARE Canada. I have been with CARE for just over a year, but I'm not new to the international development space. I've worked for larger brands like World Vision, Save the Children, Canadian Feed the Children, also CARE Canada. CARE Canada, I love our mission, where CARE helps women and girls in developing countries lift themselves and their families out of poverty. My role with CARE Canada is I am the Senior Director of Fundraising, which means I oversee all levels of giving from mass through to legacy and all the various channels. So I'm thrilled to be with you all today.
Thank you, Gail. And we'll go over next to Catherine.
Thanks, Chrislyn. Yep, Catherine Chalmers. I'm the newbie, I think, in the group. I have been with Plan International Canada for just over 4 months now, so quite new to this organization and to international development. This is my first role in this space as well, although I've spent the last close to 20 years or so in development and fundraising, mostly with not-for-profits that include cultural and arts charities and social services. So I'm thrilled to be joining you all today. Plan International Canada is an international development and humanitarian organization that seeks to advance children's rights and equality for girls. It's been around for more than 80 years and works in about 70 countries. My role at PLAN is the Vice President of Philanthropy, and I oversee a team of individual and corporate partner donors and fundraisers, as well as some events work and planned giving. And I also sort of run the gamut in terms of the individual and corporate philanthropy programs within the PLAN International Canada team. Thanks. Delighted to be here.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, everyone, and for joining us today. So before we get into our conversation, I also want to take a moment to thank our co-host, Fundraising Talents, Jason Lewis, and the Association of Fundraising Professionals, or as we all know, AFP. There are a number of resources available to fundraisers via AFP, including three that I'd like to mention. So one is AFP Connect, which is basically an online forum that allows you to connect with other fundraisers around the world and discuss challenges or learnings as they are happening. The second is a specific COVID-19 resource guide that's been put together by AFP. There's a wealth of topics that you can look up in this guide that has everything from fundraising at home during a crisis, leadership, digital events, and digital engagement with your donors, and even specific resources for Canadian fundraisers. And then finally, just want to remind everyone at the local level, if you're in the Greater Toronto area, to visit AFPToronto.org for information about more virtual workshops and events and other resources to keep you connected to the fundraising community here in Toronto. So let's get into it. The thread that sort of ties us all of us here together today is that we're all championing international causes here in Canada. We work with donors who give globally, and we're leading teams of fundraisers who are passionate about Canada's role in the wider world. So I'd like to start us off by talking a little bit about that first group, the group of donors that we work with. So it's been about 72 days, actually it's been exactly 72 days since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 as a global pandemic. And I would like to ask our guests to think about how we've been working with our donors in that time. So my first question to you all is, what kind of lessons or key turning points have you encountered so far in these 72 days when it comes to your fundraising operations or working with donors? And maybe we'll start with Linton.
Sure. Thanks, Chrislyn. So this is unprecedented, and I know the word unprecedented and pivoting we are using constantly, but for UNICEF, this is a level 3 global emergency that we've never seen before, because in UNICEF world, there's a whole bunch of national committees, and UNICEF Canada is one of 33. And so these are the wealthy nations around the world that actually exist to send money overseas to the developing world. So this is the first time a level 3 emergency has been declared that has affected the developing world and the developed world. And so what we had to recognize quickly is that our donors were worrying about themselves. And UNICEF doesn't do frontline work in Canada. We do advocacy on behalf of children's rights in Canada. So we had to completely develop a rapid communication plan that addressed donors where they're at. They're fearing for themselves, their families. They're looking for information from credible sources about how to keep their family safe, about what is a pandemic. So in the early days, we were quickly moving to weekly communications and customized for our mass market audience, and then for our high-value donors and our partners, government, who we consider a funder, and also corporations and foundations. So we had to develop a customized communication plan that talked to Canadians in UNICEF, a credible language to give them tips and tools for being Canadians in a pandemic. So that was really our first step. And so we had to work, fundraisers had to become writers working with our communications and international programs team. And then we also have colleagues from around the world that were scrambling to give us situation reports because the first countries that were hit by this were developed nations. So I'll just stop there. But that was how we quickly had to adjust and start developing communication that was rapid, that was customized, met Canadians where they're at, because they weren't really that concerned about the developing world. We had to use our credibility and our influence and our information that really could help people in developed world with developing world messages about water, sanitation, hygiene, about how to care for their kids, how to think about their mental and physical health. So maybe I'll turn it over to my other colleagues to address this as well.
Thank you, Linton. So interesting that you guys picked up on that that sort of instinct that comes out in anyone during a crisis, which is usually survival first, right? So it sounds like you guys sort of responded to that instinct in all donors' minds. So really fascinating to hear how you did that from the beginning. I wonder if we could hear from Gail about how things have been at Care Canada.
Sure. And Linton, I love what you said, and so much of that rings true for what we did at CARE. Like the initial situation, it was just such a shock. We actually turned our entire Canada team into working from home within 24 hours. So part of that, people were just in shock, getting systems up. How do they get the equipment that they need? And then what's the information that we were getting about all of our programs that were happening internationally? Because similar to UNICEF, we're part of a global confederation. And so what programs were actually needing to be paused, what we're needing to start up. And so we're actually at a category four. So I think we all have sort of different categories, but our category four is a global response from CARE. We're raising $100 million. That actually wasn't called for the first couple of weeks. So as fundraisers, it's always, what's our goal? What are we doing? But then we also had our current plans for our current fiscal year. So then we were looking at business continuity. So once people got set up at home, tried to figure out their families, their kids, their loved ones, where they were going to work, then it was, okay, what do we actually keep going from our current plans? So at Care Canada, we actually made the decision to stay the course with most of our fundraising activities that were happening. So we didn't cancel any direct mail. We didn't cancel any direct marketing campaign or telemarketing campaigns. We didn't cancel any e-blasts. The main thing that we needed to do and had a bunch of lessons learned on was incorporating COVID only asks or incorporating COVID messaging into all of our various pieces. Because one of the early lessons was any COVID-only asks were not performing for some of the reasons that Linton was saying. People were trying to figure out their own lives, their own safety. So actually having COVID messaging woven into either our development or humanitarian appeals that were going out, we've actually still found that to be the strongest. Our major gifts people, our corporate fundraisers, they went from face-to-face meetings. They would have meetings set up with corporations. Well, the corporations were now working from home. So everything shifted. And at first, people weren't comfortable with virtual video meetings. But over time, that has gotten a lot easier. We're actually finding with our middle donors, people are loving conversations more than ever because they're home. And they're actually taking the phone calls. And so for all of our relational portfolios, like middle, major, corporate, it has taken a while. We haven't stayed the course as much in those portfolios just because of what's happening in the economy. We've seen the most shifts there. Luckily, in our mass portfolio, we didn't have to pause any face-to-face acquisition because we had actually used our budget up. But a lot of our peers, all of you likely, and as well as other international members, they had to figure out what was the new acquisition plan with face-to-face being paused at least, you know, for a couple of months. So it was a lot of stress from figuring out program information, business continuity, keeping sort of the team. So there was a lot of lessons learned.
Okay, thank you, Gail. We'll come back a little bit to the effect inside our organizations a little bit later on, but I just want to pick up on something that you said there, which was that COVID messaging explicitly didn't work for as well as when it was woven into other kinds of messaging. So that's really interesting because you know, might speak to how so many of us have been bombarded by some of these pandemic messages, right? And it's a very delicate balance to be able to figure out how to reach our supporters. I would love to hear from Catherine next at Plan International Canada.
Thanks, Chrislyn. And well, my comments will echo what Linton and Gail have already shared, similar experiences from our standpoint as well. We took our time. Everyone scattered to the far corners of the community in a short space of time and needed the technical tools and that sort of thing, our teams up and to get them up and running. And then we built quite a bit of internal infrastructure to be able to more effectively reach and respond to and speak to our donors. And so we built response teams to ensure flow of communication and that sort of thing and the right content. And we took our time in terms of pulling together our COVID specific, you know, appeals and that sort of thing. But what we did do was grab as much information as we could from our global partners and from the Federation at large around what was going on in countries so that we could effectively speak to our donors as we were pivoting. I know Linton was saying we'll use that word a lot, pivoting on some of our work. And we built in, I think, a set of guiding principles for our fundraisers that have proven to be sort of essential in terms of how we review and look at working with our constituents over this period of time. And those included really prioritizing for donors, funders, and supporters relationship over revenue, focusing on shorter-term return on investment activities and some things like speed to market, prioritizing speed to market and looking for opportunities to test, learn, and scale. So on the mass side, we actually did quite a bit of work in terms of sort of testing small appeals, small tribute campaigns, retraining some of our telemarketing folks to be able to be, you know, sort of actively supporting a conversation with child sponsors, for instance, who make up a good deal of our revenue, around the idea of perhaps skipping some of their payments rather than a full-scale cancellation. So sort of testing the waters from that standpoint. And then we used and paid attention to quite a few external sort of resources that were helping us with better understanding sort of Canadian behavior and the evolution of that behavior from March to now. So looking at things like the Angus Reid tracker and sort of understanding the feeling of the larger and broader community out there. But it was also, you know, ensuring that our internal folks had the right tools and content and resources to be able to reach out and effectively steward our donor base and keep them informed and engaged in the conversation about what Plan has been and is currently doing in the communities in which we serve in the developing world. So it's been an interesting evolution and has really has forced some really wonderful things within the organization in terms of stronger integration and collaboration across teams to be able to effectively speak to and manage our constituent base.
Great. Thank you, Catherine. A lot of what everyone has been saying resonates also, and I've seen the same thing in my organization, kind of shifting gears to focus a little bit more on relationship building and really meeting donors with where they're at Amnesty. And certainly even some of the things that you mentioned, Catherine, such as changing the way that we're you know, reaching out to donors when we're doing telemarketing, you know, giving people the opportunity to lower their gifts if they need to rather than canceling. So it's really great to hear that some of the practices that are being shared across our sector. Before we kind of look internally at our organizations, from all the things that you guys have shared today, I'm wondering if you have any you know, particular donor story or some kind of anecdote that might shed light on the outcome of some of these practices that you've been putting into place. So have you heard particular stories from your donors or from someone in particular that sort of demonstrates how now 72 days in, how you've been reacting is having an effect on your donor base? And I'll leave that open-ended for anyone that wants to jump in.
So I can jump in. It's Linton here from UNICEF Canada. We have found that our monthly donor retention has actually improved during this period. And I can't believe it because we were preparing for mass cancellations or payment vacations from our monthly donor file. We have 62,000 monthly donors. We do not have a child sponsorship product, so they are funding unrestricted revenue for UNICEF Canada. And we've been heavily investing in monthly donor acquisition through door-to-door canvassing. And as we talked about, those efforts have halted. So retaining those monthly donors is key because we process $1.2 million a month from monthly donor revenue, and it's what's going to get us through this pandemic. So keeping as many of them on file as possible is kind of an overarching goal for our organization. And I do think that the increased communication to help those donors and their families navigate this pandemic and educating them that that UNICEF was on the front lines of COVID in the developing world has helped us retain those monthly donors. I also received a $100,000 commitment just before getting on this podcast, and I can't believe it. And it's because there's a female philanthropist in Canada that really wants to be associated with an international organization focused on women's empowerment and empowering Canadian female philanthropists in a global setting. And so she finds our mandate more relevant than ever. And we all know in this sector, less than 10% of Canadians give internationally. So it's just so motivating for us at UNICEF to know that we're retaining monthly donors through all of this, and we have philanthropists stepping forward. And so we need to share more of those donor stories to keep us all motivated in this sector to keep going. When some people say to us, oh, how could you possibly be fundraising through all of this?
That's amazing. What a wonderful feeling to get right before jumping on this call with us, Linton. Thank you for sharing that. Does anybody else have any donor stories or anecdotes that they'd like to share about the impact of some of the changes that you've put into place?
Yeah, Gail from CARE here. The only other thing, so we're seeing the same thing, Linton. You know, like our donors are incredible. Like cancellation rates, ours again are lower than what we expected, but we're also getting donors in our relational portfolios that, so our fiscal year ends at the end of June, and they're actually giving gifts a couple of months earlier with the message actually saying, this work is so important and aligns with our values. Thank you for what you guys are doing. And they're actually giving gifts earlier. That's a natural part of sort of the curve that we've seen in crisis giving. You know, we're also trying to look at what does that actually mean for those donors and those relationships they're giving earlier. You know, can we continue to steward and cultivate them for next year? Because, you know, then we're all going into kind of the chasm, you know, where donations are going down. And so that'll be the next thing for us all to look at is how do we honor the donors? You know, what you were saying, Catherine, it's relationship before the revenue. And so how do we look at that and have that front and center? Because it's great to get it now and thank you, donors. But what does that actually mean for our next fiscal year and the needs that are there and our donors' needs and delighting them. So it's just an interesting thing that we'll be looking at as well.
Yeah. And I would just add, that's, you know, spot on, Gail. I would just add too, from our perspective, it, you know, it's really great communication too with our donor base. We also had a couple of really significant multi-year commitments from major donors secured just before some of this became so ever present, and staying open in that communication around this new context and how they wanted to sort of fulfill that commitment or pause on that commitment has been a terrific learning and building of trust at a time with a donor in a new relationship that has been a terrific opportunity for us to strengthen that relationship and to ensure that folks feel valued and that their contribution and their investment is really having an impact. So it is really, I think, what's very interesting about this whole about COVID is the relatability to it as well from a domestic donor base that is supporting sort of what's going on internationally. There are so many similarities and I think there's great relatability and I think it's strengthening folks and their understanding of our missions all that much more strongly. So I think yeah. I think it's been terrific for us also to retain the donor relationships and I think communication is sort of key to that.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing to hear some of the impact of your actions that you've taken across the board. Something that I'm thinking of too here at Amnesty is, we've been having conversations, of course, with our offices around the world. And one of the things that we've been sort of in discussion about is this idea that in countries where citizens feel that their governments are doing a relatively okay job of responding to the crisis. And, I'm sure anybody could make an argument for or against the government response in Canada, but that's not what I want to do. But in countries where overall there is a generalization of a positive response to the pandemic, that giving towards international causes, at least to Amnesty in our case, Amnesty International, is that giving is still up and still being retained because our donors are really caring about the people who are most vulnerable in the world. And many of us know that means the causes that we're all working for. So that's something that I'm also reminded of in hearing all of you speak, but wonderful to hear the way these actions that you have taken are having impact on your fundraising. I want to take a moment now before we sort of keep going to think a little bit inwardly. All of you here today on this call are responsible not only for your fundraising operations within your organization, but also for leading the staff that do that work. And you're responsible for some of the internal management of your organization. So I want to look inward now and ask you, Gail, you brought this up a little bit and Catherine did as well. But how are you doing internally? What has that shift been like for you, for your organization, whether it's your staff going to completely working from home or whether it's required some other kind of adapting? What's that been looking like for all of you at your organizations? And how are you supporting the fundraisers that are doing this work?
Okay, it's Linton here at UNICEF. So we decided very early on, we actually were fortunate enough to have a BCP, a business continuity sort of plan and program, and a group of staff that were responsible for this. So we started meeting very early. We actually had planned a work from home rehearsal on the Monday that, everything shut down. So we actually were ready to go. Coincidentally, which was so fortunate. But our BCP team met every morning for the first 3 weeks, and we decided very early that people were our number one priority. And so we looked at things just like, Catherine was talking about prioritizing relationships versus revenue. We decided internally that the framework we were going to use to make decisions was people, purpose, and process in that order. And so the fact that we could reassure our people once we did a scan of our financial sort of situation that people, we were going to put people, and that included staff, donors, volunteers, our stakeholders, our supporters, at the very beginning, I think reassured our staff, including our fundraisers, because our fundraisers, we have these targets on our back regardless of what our colleagues tell us, we do, and we don't want to be fundraising to fund our own salaries. And that's a very precarious, scary position to be in. And we wanted to reassure our staff at the very beginning that we will cut pretty much every expense before we're going to lay off people. And I think that really helped people feel reassured right off the top that we were going to avoid layoffs at all costs. So that was really important for us to communicate right off the top, and that we were going to pursue, and we actually led some of the sector advocacy for the charitable sector. Samantha Nutt led a group, and our CEO, David Morley, went on the media and said he was advocating on behalf of the sector to get government support. And we have actually successfully applied for the wage subsidy. And we were very transparent with our staff and our fundraisers, because they feel very vulnerable at this point, that we wanted to keep their roles, and we were going to apply for government support, and we were going to lobby on behalf of the sector. So that's sort of how we started the conversation with our staff internally.
People, purpose, process. That's a really wonderful way of thinking about it. We'd love to hear how some of the other organizations have been handling.
This is Catherine. I'll jump in as well. Similar to Linton, and I love that as well. Prioritizing people was critical, ensuring that they had the right tools. We have a really interesting staff in that, I'm sure like many of my colleagues, we run the gamut from millennials all the way past, you know, like boomers all the way through. So people reacted, you know, in very different ways to the work from home sort of mandate. We all continue to praise our IT departments for ensuring we all had the right tools, and they continue to roll those out seamlessly with very, very little challenges. So that was wonderful to feel empowered that we had the tools that we could to manage our workload. And then it quickly became, some work we needed to do on the meeting culture, because we found the way to stay connected was through meetings, and you don't get the benefit of just walking past somebody's desk in the office and having a sidebar conversation. So everything becomes a 15 or a 30 or, you know, an hour long sort of meeting. And, making sure that not only were we facilitating those meetings in an effective manner, ensuring, you know, on a weekly basis that everyone understood what their roles and responsibilities were, what they were going to be held accountable for, ensuring that we were clear about sort of deliverables, much like Linton was saying. As fundraisers, people have targets and are results driven. Wanted to keep up that momentum within this new context. And we also found, at least with my team, I found the effectiveness of finding some fun and play in some of our meetings and get-togethers. So ensuring music's involved at times, ensuring we are sharing resiliency quotes in some of our, end of week check-ins, that sort of thing. So some of those pieces allow folks to bring their humanness to the table too, which allows them to feel a little bit more connected, I think, and engaged. And for me, because I was so new to the organization, it's been a wonderful experience to build the trust of and the relationships across this team while doing it virtually and remotely, which I found I thought was going to be much more challenging than it has been. So it's been wonderful.
Yeah, this is Gail.
Thank you, Catherine.
Oh, no, go ahead, Chrysalis.
No, I just was going to, I would love to hear how things are at CARE, Gail.
Yeah, so I would say it took us a while to get to sort of the happy zone because people were, 24 hours working from home, working through their plans, business continuity, keeping in contact with donors. It took a while. And then there was the, family situations, whether it was kids or other loved ones, trying to figure that out, trying to figure out, how much to set up an office. People were having calls from their balconies at their condos because they were living with multiple people. They didn't have chairs at home. So getting them the right equipment. So like we really focused on staff well-being, but I would say that that's one of the things of learning what people needed helping people because they didn't have transitions of commutes? Everybody knows what they sort of need, but pausing to say, encourage people to take walks in the morning? What's the YouTube sort of video to numb your brain, get your day into gear? There was so much information that was coming out about our program work, about COVID, about the news reports. And so then there was a lot of conversations about narrowing focus. How do you actually narrow your own focus about things happening, information to pay attention to? And then also encouraging us all to be present and listen to ourselves and our staff and what people needed, because it was uncertainty. There was a lot of things happening. And so I wouldn't say it was sort of a knock it out of the park for us and people were rocking it out. It is still something that we are putting a lot of attention to, and also have, a little bit of concern, because we will not be going back to an office environment the way we knew it sort of ever. And so how do we do this? And how do we do this in a way that sort of honors all the various ways that people need to work? Some people just love those hallway connections, the water cooler talk. So how do we help, facilitate that? And so it's something that we're continuing to work our way through.
So I can't, as I've had the pleasure to listen to these six conversations for our listeners, this is the last in this series of six. I have to say to all four of you, this is perhaps the most upbeat, positive conversation I have listened to in the last 8 weeks. And you all probably can't feel the collective enthusiasm as much as I can, because I just get the pleasure of sort of sitting back and listening. But I also have to say that my Canadian friends north of us, as I'm sort of representing the only American in the room, there's just a positivity in here, and it's hard to get some of us Americans. We're also cranky and stuff sometimes. But what is it? How are you all, as we sort of wind this conversation down, how are you going to keep this positivity alive? Because there's still so much more yet to be done. And so I can't let you wrap it up without answering that question for me. How are we going to keep this positive energy going?
I'll start. It's Linton here from UNICEF. I think we're all working for organizations that can do something about this pandemic. And so I feel quite lucky that I work for an organization that's at the front line. I mean, we vaccine more children than any other organization. We deliver water and sanitation solutions. So we're at the forefront of this pandemic. So we're in jobs where we can actually do something about the situation. And I think that keeps us motivated. It keeps our staff feeling like they're part of something important. And I feel like, global organizations, we are set up to work online with our global colleagues. So we are at an advantage to be positive. And Canadians are global citizens. We care about the world around us. We understand our connectivity. We're a country with a lot of newcomers. So we have the opportunity to be global and to do something about it. That's how I feel positive.
And I would say, to add to Linton's comments there, it's Catherine at Plan. I also want to say that having lived in the States too, Canada is also very, very sort of understands the whole global connectivity piece. So I'm also inspired by, as you've heard in these conversations, some of the work that we've been doing with our donor base here and other constituents, supporters and funders, who really do get that global citizen piece and understand it and understand the impact that they can have, and that helping support the work that we engage in with these developing countries lifts boats for everyone. And so it is a great place to be. We've also had lots of experience dealing with crises, not exactly like this, but we have experience. We know how to get work on the ground into the right hands. We know how to cascade that information. We know sort of the cadence of how the work should unfold, and how to stay sort of connected, how to influence and motivate government and other sort of important stakeholders in those developing countries, and how to get those resources into their hands to make some of that happen. So I think it's also, again, just as Linton said, it's a terrific place to be at this point in time in Canada, and with our stakeholders who are supporting the work that we've been engaged in for a long time. But Canada comes with a different ethos around that sort of global citizen piece.
Right.
Yeah, this is Gail from CARE here. Like, I love what you both have said, Catherine and Linton. I agree, but I also think that there's some hard times coming. There's some key strategic decisions, like in our industry, like income growth, like it's plateaued and it's starting to drop. There was things of decisions that we all, as a international development world, needed to make decisions of years ago, right? And so, like, I think we are all motivated by our mission. How do we collaborate? How do we talk? How do we look at the data? How do we exercise that muscle? I do think that there's tough times coming, but let's keep talking to each other. Let's focus on our well-being, our team's well-being. Let's focus on relationships, of our revenue, making hard decisions, but good decisions. Like, I don't think it's going to be an easy, cheery road ahead.
I agree. We'll need to test and innovate for sure, and stop doing the things that really we probably should have a long time ago that just aren't working. Yeah. And pivot to sort of new and innovative ways to deliver on our mission for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Jason, you know, the one thing that I'm hearing from all of our guest responses is this theme of intention. Whether that is being intentional in how you're reaching out to your donors, whether that's being intentional about incorporating fun and play and those kind of water cooler conversations in a virtual world for your staff. It seems like we're now kind of, you know, moving into a world where in the past we've had to be reactive, and certainly we've all had to react to this pandemic. The future of our work is really going to kind of depend on us being incredibly intentional about how we want to build the next phase, right? So that's something that I'm kind of really inspired by hearing everybody speak today. It's just this idea of kind of shifting from, you know, going from being reactive to being really intentional about how we connect with each other and how we connect with our donors going forward.
So, Chrislyn, we wanted to create the reason we agreed to collaborate in this way is we wanted to really create sort of a conversation piece that all of your chapter members could sort of turn to. And this is an extraordinary way of sort of wrapping this up. But for those people who are perhaps listening, say in the Toronto area or anywhere else, and they're interested in learning more about your organization, perhaps they want to reach out and to communicate with one of you, however that might be, what would your suggestions be?
Well, I would definitely recommend anybody in the Greater Toronto area to visit afptoronto.org to check out any of the latest events or virtual workshops that might be happening as time goes on. They'll constantly be updated. And of course, if you are an AFP member, you're already getting emails about all of that information already. And then on the more sort of Canadian or global scale, to consider checking out some of those other resources, which include the AFP COVID resource guide that has a lot of links and information about how you can fundraise in this new climate that we're all in, as well as AFP Connect, which is an online forum for you to be able to connect with other fundraisers across the globe who might be experiencing the same things that you are in a pandemic or not, but certainly all resonate with that that moniker that we all carry, which is to be a fundraiser and to inspire people to give. So would highly recommend that you check out any of those resources if you're listening today.
So Chrislyn, and to everyone else, it has certainly been a pleasure to host your conversations. To all of you, if you're interested in coming back, we broadcast a couple of times a week, and we like to always have a fundraising professional, kind of a no-expert sort of show, and we like to talk with individuals who are on the front lines doing the work that you all have been talking about. So if you want to come back and have a conversation about a big idea or bold opinion as it relates to the fundraising profession, you're always welcome back. Thank you, Chrislyn, for co-hosting with me. This is your first time doing it, right?
Yeah, it was my first time.
I think we can all give you a big applause. I think you did wonderfully. To all of you, have a wonderful afternoon, and thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.